The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another, and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes. Stomps.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
Welcome back to the Burrows of Berea. I am Rick Welch, and to my right is Rick Big Daddy Carter.
Oh, yeah.
Andy, I need you to pan that hard left and hard right.
Oh, I didn't do the other one. I forgot to do that.
Yeah, but you didn't do it last time, but let's do it this time.
Okay.
Say it again, Rick.
Oh, yeah.
How'd you like that going from your left ear to your right ear?
As it blows your speakers out of your car.
Behind the glass is Rocket Man Andy Bishop. And Tiziana, Mom So Hard Subverse.
Woo!
How you momming so hard?
We almost made it to church on time today.
That is definitely a
we
mom sentence.
We only missed the opening song.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we are back in the studio again. My guest, Alan Bondar, is here. Hello, Alan.
Woo! Hello. Welcome.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. He is the author of How to Kill God the Easy Way, a title that I loathe with my entire heart. And I have told him this I don't know how many times, but this is my platform, and so I will say it again.
I'm gonna say whatever I want.
Was that your title, or did it come from a publisher? So, because it's such a good title. The fact that you hate it is part of why it's a good title. It is a great title.
Thank you, Andy. We will
get into that in a minute about why I think you're wrong. You're right about one thing, but you're wrong about who he's trying to reach.
I've never seen that happen before, but I'll wait.
I listened to you do an interview on YouTube today in prep for this conversation, and you were talking about this, so I'm excited to hear you say it personally.
Gotcha. To answer your question, Andy, no, that was my title. I came up with it.
Yes.
Man, it's just like, if you see that on a piece of paper, you're going to look at it twice.
That's what I said.
It's kind of borrowed.
Is it?
Of course it is.
I read this interview. Well, I was listening to you talk with this guy today, and you were talking about how you were making a joke about how to quit smoking the easy way.
Yeah.
And because it was like it had something to do with like when you were quitting smoking and how that process worked for you and how it came down to sort of deconstructing your own mind and convincing yourself that you didn't like something that you like, that stop convincing yourself that you liked something you didn't actually like. And so it was a process of like deconstructing of this belief. And so when it was like how to kill God the easy way, it was like how the process of listening to his book about how to quit smoking helped you get, like, gave you permission to quit God almost in some ways.
That also has to be a joke on another level though.
Yeah, no. So there was no connection there.
Okay.
The connection to the title is there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it didn't have anything to do with me leaving atheism. That I did not make that connection that deprogramming my mind.
Yeah, the deprogramming part.
Yeah, that was why I ended up naming it that, because
yes,
when I realized that works in the same way, I was like, this is a cool title. So
yeah.
So yeah, so it's connected to that, but he just asked if a publisher gave it to me. I think I'm allowed,
I'll go ahead and say it on my platform, but it was in regard to Alan Carr's work,
yeah,
How to Quit Smoking the Easy Way.
Correct.
The Easy Way method, basically, his method,
correct,
right?
Correct.
Yeah. So
it's
so,
like, to me, it's like if you had like an infomercial with Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. But who is your target audience?
Well, my target audience is Christians.
Okay.
That's who I want to read it. But of course, any atheist could read it and glean a lot of things. And I think, personally, I think there's a lot of atheists that are, or even if you're not an atheist, left Christianity, but you haven't landed anywhere particular.
You can believe in, let's say, capitalism. No reason, literally. You can believe in capitalism and read books about it.
Sure. You can be a spiritualist. Like there's a lot of room between theism and atheism to land. So I think anybody can read it and glean a lot from it. And I think personally, there's a lot of people who have left Christianity that are holding on to things that are still infiltrating their mind that they won't even realize they're holding on to still. And so my book will continue to remove that brainwashing and help them get it all removed. And that's really what I want to do. So I find that it helps with the Christians that are gung-ho to see a lot of things like you saw, but it doesn't take him the whole gambit yet. I'm hoping it does eventually. But then
he has a motive,
of course. but you know, like I said, you're one of the ones that I don't worry about. Like you're fine. Like keep being a Christian. I don't care. Like it's more the mystery to me as why didn't it work for Rick? That's all it is. But between that and atheism, like I said, there's a lot of room there where you've left, but you may not have removed it all. And so that's, so my target audience also ultimately Christians, but anybody in the gambit would work. I will say that if you're a Christian and you're questioning your faith at all, or you've gone through some of the things that Tiziana and I have gone through, and you're a little frustrated with Christianity, I can tell you right now, if you read this book, it very likely will take you over the edge.
Yeah, and Andy, since Andy brought it up, I just want to go ahead and get it out in the room and air it out and be done with it. To hate capitalism and read a book about capitalism is one thing, but you don't think of capitalism as a person. You haven't built a foundation. Like, we all are capitalists in our society, but we don't really think about capitalism in that way. We're in it. We're immersed in it. Whenever we read the Bible, or you're in a church setting and people, you're talking about Jesus as a real person. God is a real person. It's someone who has affected you, right? So whenever you talk about killing somebody, how to kill God, and it means something a lot to you and your parents and your grandparents, all of your traditions, all of the things that you've had in your life, it's hard to crack that book. And I told Alan, my thought is that they're not afraid of the book. They're angry at the title. Fear doesn't hit like it did for me. It didn't hit until I opened the title. Once I opened it and I started getting into it,
you could get past that initial reaction.
The first episode, I entered into it. I had my reasons of why I entered into it, and I'll talk about it later. I want Alan to talk, but I just wanted to make that point: is that if you want a Christian, whether they're questioning or not,
it's hard for me to understand. Like I can intellectualize that position,
sure,
but it's hard for me to come from that position.
Yeah,
it's like, to me, the closest analog would be like How to Kill Benjamin Franklin the easy way. Like,
right.
I, despite his flaws, big fan of Benjamin Franklin. And like, I could not imagine being mad at that. That's just funny to me.
Right. But
I don't take Benjamin Franklin the same way.
You don't get up every Sunday morning and get dressed.
So I don't have like,
yeah.
So yeah, I don't have, although I can understand what you're saying, I don't have a good analog that fits emotionally.
But I think I would parallel it more, although I appreciate your parallel, I would parallel it more with How to Kill the Easter Bunny the easy way. Because to me, Santa Claus.
So, yeah, that's a little closer.
I'm removing a piece of the brainwashing right out the gate by establishing or downplaying the idea that God is even real.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just trying to like.
It's also one of those things where it's the title takes it as a given that he can be killed,
right?
And so it kind of bypasses that step entirely,
right? And if I actually believed God was real, as Christians do, you're not going to kill God, obviously, not mm-hmm. the real God. I'm establishing the idea right out the bat that it's just an idea, and I'm helping to remove it. That's what I was trying to go for with the title. You and I have extensively talked about it, and I still understand your reasons.
I'm just telling you that primarily most Christians aren't going to do it.
Are you trying to get personal?
And I'll tell you why I did.
Are you trying to get personal with Christians?
Personal?
Yeah.
In the book, I do. Yeah, sure.
Well, I mean, it
I don't think he that's means what sucks. In the way.
Well, that's what sucks. People, when you read the book, like he does this masterful job of showing how brainwashing in Christianity, it's religion across the board, but in Christianity, because he knows it, because he was raised in it, how brainwashing is used in several forms of it, by the way.
We were just talking about this in that last episode that we did, because I've been coming to the same conclusion about like fundamentalist right-wing Christianity, Christian nationalism, anything that you would call it like a high-control evangelical religion and sect of Christianity, you know, because they really do, like they use these techniques that are brainwashing techniques that other people, as Stephen Hassan is one of the other books I was reading, I've been reading a lot of his work too, like how to love people out of that. And when he describes what he calls the bite model of control, that you control someone's behavior, you control the flow of information, you control their thoughts, and then
emotions.
You can control their emotions. And so that's like, you know, when we grew up in these high control religions, you're not allowed to watch anything that's not sanctioned by the church. You're not allowed to listen to music that's not sanctioned by the church. That's partially how the church controls the flow of information so that it can control what you think and don't think, because it's controlling what you don't have access to. Sure.
So he does that. See, and that's the beauty of it. So Stephen Hassan, he's broke it all out, which is mm-hmm. great for like determining cult behavior. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. He does the same thing. He just didn't call it the bite model. He does it in an entirely yeah. different way, from a very personal view mm-hmm. within Christianity.
It's fascinating.
It's a great way to do it, and it can really help. But he puts this little disclaimer at the beginning of his book, in his introduction. And he says, what have you got to lose? If you're a Christian, if anything, this is going to make, you know, and strengthen your faith. Or you're going to walk out. One of the two things are going to happen. And so yeah. I looked at that and I was like, all right, well, if this guy really means what he says, then I'm going to go through this. And I was going to go through with it anyway. That was my whole plan, yeah. was because I knew in my heart that if any Christians are going to get involved in this, they're not going to follow through. Because all he asked for was read the book and do a survey on my mm-hmm. website at the end. That's all I'm asking for. Mm-hmm. And I was like, he's going to get let down, because this is not what Christians are going to do. They're not going to follow through. And I think that that was your experience, and maybe not fully, but you know, a low percentage actually responded.
Correct.
Me and Dr. Sam Frost and a few others.
Well, that was the standpoint of the reason for my question was, are you trying to get personal? I know the content is personal question, but the title alone, it, like Rick said, I mean, from a Christian standpoint, and coming from a huge fundamentalist background, the title alone is almost a personal question, and something that a fundamentalist person will not crack the book open to even.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just chuck it, just like.
So I understand. And so two other thoughts in regards to why I called it that. Number one, I don't know that if anybody's going to read my book by any other title, that they're not going to read it anyway by this title.
At this point, you mean?
No, at any point. I struggle to think that that there's much that...
That there's some magical combination of 3 to 6 words that would make Christians just run.
Well, yeah, I just don't know yeah. that I have an audience big enough that's going to suddenly make a whole bunch of Christians worldwide be like, oh my goodness, I want to read that book because it's called I Love Jesus and I Might Not Anymore or something. Oh, I don't know. What a good title.
Right.
Can I make this clickbait?
So it's not clickbait though.
Well, I meant the title.
Oh, I don't want it to be clickbait. That's why I was honest with the title.
Well, I get that. But in order to get the reader involved, it's almost got to be clickbaitish in order to get the involvement.
Yeah, that. And so that kind of leads to my second reason, or my third, I guess, now that we're on the third one, is what I think the title has done, and it's kind of proven to done it, is it has created such a point of conversation that it's becoming permeated in the community. Everybody's talking about how crazy this title is. So in a way, I've gotten this book title in front of everybody's minds, because I've done now 5 shows and the only thing we could talk about is the title of the title. So I got you talking about this title so much, I can't get you to go to sleep without thinking about it.
I was talking about it forever. I'm so sick and tired of hearing it.
Yeah. But I'm
tired of it.
Now you're going to have a whole audience of hearing about it, because all we can talk about is the title. So
now you get to get the emails about talking about it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to get the ones that are like, why in the hell did you let Alan Bondar on your show? Number one, why did you give him the time of day and all that crap? Because I love him. I think he's a wonderful man. I actually do. I really like Alan.
You can
a lot.
Mail and be mean to me
I like
for
hug
a little
him
while.
And love on him. I love this guy. I even told him how beautiful he was when he came
right
up.
Now, group
Rocket, Rocketman at burrowsaberia.com.
There you go. You could be mean to me for a little while. If you need to be mean to a member of the Burrows, I can.
But everybody loves Andy. Everybody yeah. just loves little
yes,
Andy. He's
do.
The innocent one.
Oh, it's impossible yeah. not to.
All you have to do is shower.
I don't know. TZ, you've known me too long. That was very sweet.
Yeah.
I have known you too long. And we have had very strong words with each other multiple times.
If you really want
to. And it is very difficult to not love you.
Listen, the best way to get Andy, I've known him for 25 years. Just shower him with love and affection and lots of kind words, and he will literally melt and doesn't know what to do with himself. He's like, I don't like it when you talk about me. Okay, enough.
Right.
Let's That's talk cute. About how beautiful Andy is today. Anyway, so yeah, so I hate the title. Let's move on.
But we've spent like, what, 10 minutes on it now?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, and I, as usual, am like the, but actually in the room, because I think it's a great title.
Yeah.
Andy. I think it's a very provocative
Andy,
title.
Andy, if you don't mind, Thank could you please delete yeah. the first 11 minutes of this episode?
Absolutely.
Just kidding. Now, so where we left off is that you had started a full preterist church. Obviously, we know that you're an atheist now. So take us on that journey. Tell us as much or as little as you want. I'd like to get to the point to where because after talking with you, I know it has nothing to do at all with full preterism. It has nothing to do, like, it's really kind of surprising how he comes to it. So tell us.
Yeah, I guess I'll tell the parts that are pertinent to play, so I don't get too personal and too detailed. There's a lot in my book, though, that I won't tell. So if you're interested, again, grab the book and you can read the whole thing. After about 10 years of my church, we ended up shutting it down due to circumstances. My ex-wife and I now went through a divorce. That was a couple years process there, but the church had shut down. There was no leadership yet at the time that was willing to step up and keep the church going. So unfortunately, we had to shut it down. And I was not in a mental state to be able to do that at the time. It was just a really, really bad time in my life. I moved back to Maryland, had to move in with my parents for a while, go through a lot of therapy to deal with a lot of the struggles that I had dealt with and get through the divorce and all that kind of stuff. So that's a very, very abbreviated version, but the rest of that's a whole lot of personal stuff that I went through. But anyway, so here I am in Maryland, going through therapy, dealing with a lot of things. As I'm getting healed, as I'm getting my head straight, as I'm coming back to and getting stronger, now I'm working for USPS, I've got a great job, I'm like, I'm going to plant another church. I was dead set on following God to the grave. There was never, in any single circumstance, even when I got kicked out of every church, it never once caused me to take an even slip up of my faith and say, God, what are you doing? How come this? I was just like, God, I know you're glorious. You've got this. That was my whole attitude, always. So even here, I had no doubt I was definitely going to plant another church. And then time was going on. I wasn't able to go to church because I was working on Sundays. I had to deliver packages for Amazon. That's what we did at USPS on Sundays. So I wasn't constantly getting fed the brainwashing, as I call it, at the church. So it wasn't continuously coming in. I wasn't doing all that. I remember going to church one week with my parents as I was starting to get out, and I looked around, and it was just so weird. It reminded me of like a clown show. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but like I looked around, everybody was just sitting there doing the same thing. Everybody was just being commanded by this guy on the stage, stand up, sit down, take the Lord's Supper. And I'm just like—
It was one of those really good clown shows.
Yeah, really good clown show. But it was just weird to me. And for the first time, I was like the only person awake in the whole church looking around. And I was like, what is going on here? Why is everybody just following these instructions, singing the same songs? And it was weird. I never saw it that way. I mean, I was always the guy at front leading. But now it was just odd to me. So I just remember that vividly. I was like, wow, that is a really weird thing. So I was already escaping, clearly, and I didn't even realize I was escaping. I'd met with a friend of mine, his name Jeremiah. I talk about him in my book. And I hadn't seen him in many years. He was one of my best friends in college. But we had lost touch for a while. I went to full preterism, and he did, and then he ended up going back to a futurist position because of his tradition and stuff. But somewhere along the line, he became an atheist. And I had not an atheist, sorry. He's one of these that left Christianity but did not go to atheism. He went to a different view of some sort, the Norse gods or something like that. I don't understand the view. I can't criticize it because I don't understand it enough to do that. So, but it's fine. It is what it is. But anyway, sitting with him at dinner, we're hanging out, we're talking, I'm finding out he's there. And I'm like, it was the first time that I thought Christianity is actually something that you don't need. It was like, it just never occurred to me that there's an actual world outside of Christianity. This was it. This is all there was. You either are a Christian or you're not. And if you're not, you're done. That's against God. You have to live for God. And here he is. He's sitting on the outside of it looking in. And he's saying, bro, there's a really awesome world out here. He's like, it's a mind virus. And I was like, mind virus? Whoa, that's crazy. So, he was like, he reached into my cave and into my prison cell and basically said, bro, you can come out of here. And I was just shocked. Number one, that he was out. And number two, that there was a world out there and he said, it's wonderful out here. So I went home that night and went to bed, did my normal thing. Next day, got up and did the same thing that I do every day. Went out for a prayer walk. And I'm walking down and I'm praying and I'm literally in the middle of praying and I just stopped. And I said, what am I doing? I'm literally talking to the air. I was like, there's no response, nobody listening. It was like my whole life flashed before me, and I kind of had to look every single thing I had ever gone through. I had to do. It wasn't like it wasn't like that, there was any moment where God came and like flew me off the ground and I was like, here, sir, and then dropped me into the middle of a church plant. Like, I literally had to work my ass off in every single thing that I did. Growing the church was marketing, constant marketing. There was no Holy Spirit bringing people. If there was, that'd be nice. But no, I had to do everything. Going through my therapy, I had to pull myself up. I had to meet with my therapist. I had to call people. And it's always like flooded in. And I suddenly realized, I was like, it's just been me. Me and the people that have helped me. There was no God. And it was just like, in that very moment, I said out loud, I'm an atheist. Which is exactly what happened when I became a prayerist.
As he was on his prayer walk.
As I was on my prayer walk. And wow. That ended my prayer walk. I think I wept for a while.
Wow. That's real interesting. I guess I've never really imagined the shift because it didn't, you know what I mean? Because like, I don't have like anything, a life story that is anything like yours. And it's funny to imagine the shift as feeling that quick. Obviously there must be some sort of subconscious scaffolding at that point. I can only assume.
And but that's what my book's about. That's what my book's about. Exactly. There is. I just didn't know there was in that moment. So here I am, an atheist now. And like I said, it took me a while to get my head around this. I was just like, oh my goodness. I just literally spent 40 years of my life in something that isn't even real. You just imagine that.
It's like a death, isn't it?
It felt like, yeah, it was like a complete grief. Death.
Yeah.
Boy, that took me some time. I almost went through another depression. That was like, but at the same time, there was also this great release and this freedom. So I was going back between, oh my goodness, this is amazing. I can do anything I want. There's nobody going to judge me for it or destroy my life. I can think this horrible thought and there's nobody there judging me. Like, I couldn't believe it. Like, nobody hears it. Nobody sees it. There's no God saying to me, how dare you, son? I literally could think anything I want. It was so freeing. And I was like, but all the sad parts were the fact that I just spent 40 years of my life not living like that. Man, was that frustrating. It took me some time, a couple of years, I went underground. You know, reminded me of the Apostle Paul, you know, for 3.5 years, went and studied. So I just disappeared. I ended up dating for a while. I ended up meeting Ray, my current partner. She's absolutely amazing. We have a great relationship, and we ended up meeting each other on an app called Hinge. So if you're looking to date, I recommend that app. It is wonderful. The advantage to it is you can like actually send a message, you know, to try to capture their attention, you know, rather than just a click and swipe or whatever. So
was your first one How to Date Alan Bondar the Easy Way?
It was
it grabbed her attention.
It was actually the hard way. And when I realized the hard way didn't work, I went to the easy way. That was the difference. But I'm sure there's a lot of days she wishes she knew how to kill Alan the easy way. That would be.
She knows how.
She knows how.
I just want you to be afraid when you go to sleep tonight.
Oh, man. I'm sure that you gave her some ideas. I have no doubt.
But don't worry. The afterlife is easy.
The afterlife is easy? That's good. Yeah. Especially for me.
Oh, boy.
So I went underground, I just lived my life. I didn't care about anything else. I just wanted to live in peace for a while and just enjoy this newfound freedom. I wasn't out trying to save the world or tell anybody about it. I wasn't an atheist evangelist or anything of that sort. I just went quiet and just enjoyed my life with her for a few years. And then this evil girl named Jen Fishburne decides to ask me to come out of my shell and do an interview with the world. And I was like, you know, I guess I can do that. That's not a big deal. I'm grateful for it now because thanks to her, she reached into that cave and said, get the hell out here. We need you again. You know, it was nice. So it was like, felt like I was useful again and had some purpose in life. But anyway, so
Jen Fishburne has a very similar story to Alan's, a long time within the Christian faith. And then she eventually worked her way out of it.
I have seen some of her videos.
Yeah. And she's where Answers in Genesis is the name of her
Answers
page.
From Genesis.
Answers from Genesis. Yeah. Answers in Genesis
is
Ken Ham's. Yeah. Stuff.
Hers is a play on word. Answers from J-E-N.
Genesis. Her name's Jen.
Brilliant title. Love her show. And by the way, Evil was tongue-in-cheek. I obviously think the world of her. She's great.
She's a very, very, very smart person.
Very.
Very smart.
Yeah. That's why I'm on her show. So I let her make me look like I'm smarter than I am. When I don't know what to say, I'm just like, what do you think about that, Jen?
I saw that interview. And when I watched it, I was like, man, you looked like,
Hell warmed over?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That was the word. It was kind of like you were, I don't know, maybe questioning whether you wanted to be on the show or not, even at that moment, and kind of stepping back in and a little disheveled, just kind of, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, you were kind of like a deer in the headlights.
That's a good way of putting it, disheveled, yeah.
That's what it looked like.
I hadn't spoke publicly since I lost my, shut my down church, which was, would have been seven years at that point.
Well, yeah. And also, it's like, it was probably one of your first opportunities where you were just Alan. Right. You were just talking for you.
Right.
You weren't this great spokesman for God. You weren't feeling that pressure of having to be the spokesman for Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit of God. You were just yourself.
That's not only that, but because he had left, now you've got all of the friends and all of the associates over all the years that are going to hear this story, and that's going to start bringing – when you go public, it's going to start bringing the heat. And I imagine you probably heard some of it.
Oh, that was
I certainly read it and saw it like all over social media, which I can't, that kind of stuff really irritates me.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind heat if it's dealing with the
content.
The content. Yeah. But there was a lot of when personal attacks.
It goes personal attacks. Yeah. I don't like that stuff either.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, we did the interview and yeah, it was very sloppy. I wasn't on my game at all, but it's okay. It was the first time I came out and, you know, I was rusty as all get it. And that's fine. And like I said, I was telling my story for the first time. And I didn't really take the time to really think about it because it's your story. How can you get it wrong? But at the time, I didn't think of anything called reconsolidated memory. I learned about that later when I was writing my book. That's where you remember things differently than they actually occurred because you remember them according to your current situation and the way, you know, you however it was that you went through it at the time, that's how you recall it. So I had, you know, recalled that there was nobody there for me during my depression. Well, when you're depressed, that's the way you think. And so that's the way I told the story. And then afterwards, I was like, was that true? So I went and did an addendum, but, you know, it was already out. You know, it was too late and we tried, but everybody was critiquing. Oh, you lied. You said there was nobody there for you. I was there for you. I was like, oh, Jesus, man. Seriously?
Yeah, but you can say that now. He and I talked at length about this, and I agree with Alan on this. With this, as far as reconsolidated memory is concerned with him, when you are in a state of depression, like he was, and the way that he viewed the world, maybe people were reaching out, but man, you're not seeing it or feeling it or noticing it because it's so in your head.
Singularity of a moment.
Or you're just saying no and kind of rolling over.
Right.
And then, but since that person, they weren't there, but they're just like, they're not willing to cross boundaries to do so. All of a sudden you're like, nobody's here.
No, you're absolutely right. My depression was so bad. Like I would just lay in bed for weeks before I even would roll out and take a shower. Like the only time I would get out would be to go to work because I had to. And I would like have to grab myself out and basically crawl out the door. It was awful.
You'd become
a black
hole.
Think about all of the experiences that he had been robbed of because of this deeply fundamental Christian belief or just Christianity to him and at all.
Yeah.
But so many things were robbed from him because he said no when he probably would have done it. I mean, he might have lived the rock star life because he loved rock music. He could have done whatever he wanted, you know?
That's right. That's right. Well, oddly enough, I left the band because I was going to be a pastor and
there it is.
My ex-wife didn't want to be a part of that life. So
yeah.
It turns out it was the best thing that ever happened for the band because I definitely am not a singer, but that's all I could do. So... And I started the band, so they couldn't kick me out. So, yeah.
Leaving was a really... They can kick you out.
That's part of the sorrow, right? Is like stopping and thinking about what could have been. And especially when, you know, you realize that the carrot you were chasing was never there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
So it was during that interview, though, that Jen asked me the question, which wouldn't be a big deal, but to me it was mind-blowing. She said... What made you decide to leave Christianity? What happened? And I'm like, I don't know.
Deer in the headlights.
It's just shot like that. But and then here's Puzzle Man Alan. I can't let that go. Now I'm like, thanks a lot, Jen. I had became a dog on a bone. I had to know the answer. Why? Because I remember the day it happened, but it didn't make any sense. Like, why that moment? What was the reason for that? It just didn't add up.
Yeah.
And that's where you were talking about the layers comes in. But I didn't pick up on that. So I had to go on a journey. And so I was like, I have to figure this out. Why did I leave Christianity?
Right, because that's huge.
Something else that's been left out of this is that prior to this, he was also a Christian author. And listen, I've just heard this in a lot of the circles that I'm in. That Alan's books are what you would consider like classics. Like they're very well put together, very well studied. And one of them, The Journey Between the Veils, I keep hearing about all the time. Like, it needs to be on every preterist bookshelf. So he's already an author, and he's already went through these things through his faith and made him rock solid enough to where Christians want to come and read his work. So now he's about to enter into this new phase where he's like, he's developing why he left Christianity. Now he's going to do the same thing, but outside of the church.
What if your self-help coach was your captor? What if empowerment meant obedience, and a colored sash meant you belonged to someone? This is the true story of Nexium, a personal development company that promised growth and delivered control. We're going inside the minds behind the headlines. Keith Raniere, the so-called genius who weaponized belief. Nancy Saltzman, the therapist who professionalized submission. And Allison Mack, the actress who helped brand women into silence. We'll hear from survivors, whistleblowers, and the families who fought to bring the truth to light. This isn't just a cult story. It's a case study in how ambition, psychology, and charisma can become chains. Listen to our new series of Sashes and Slaves, coming soon only on Patreon. Go to www.patreon.com/theburrowsofberea.
Yeah, well, for the first time, I was like, I didn't even know that I was going to write the book at that moment. All I knew was I had to know why. Like, I was very unsettled. Thanks to Jen, I became extremely unsettled. Like, what caused it? And I thought, okay, the only way I'm going to figure this out is if I go back into Christianity for a bit in my head and re-entrench myself a little bit and see what it was. What did I like so much about it, and why did I want to leave it? So I started listening to the Christian music again. All the songs that I used to love, man, praise songs. And literally, that's all I would listen to. You, like, almost like trying to brainwash myself again, you know, although didn't know that's what I was trying to do. But I was listening, reading my Bible, reading through the prayer. I used to love doing this. Why don't I love doing this anymore? What was so great about this? And, you know, not so much praying because I already didn't believe it, but, you know, just wondering what was it about that day? Just questioning. So that's what I was doing. And I was driving down the road one day and listening to these songs, and one song came up, "Addicted to Jesus, Addicted to God." It was DC Talk and Carmen, and they kept repeating that, and I was like, "That's it!" It just hit me like a ton of bricks. I was like, "I wonder if the same reason I was able to quit smoking is why I left Christianity and didn't even realize it." Because I remember Alan Carr talked about in his book that when he quit smoking, he didn't even realize why he did either. Just one day, he just said, "I'm done," and that was it. And he had to do the same thing, go on a journey to figure out what he did. And he realized it was removing the brainwashing that helped him overcome his addiction. And he realized that if you don't want to do something, it's not hard to not do it. So as long as you think you like something and love something, it's really hard to stop. So I realized, like, what if it's the same thing? So I said, I decided to test my theory. And I said, "I bet you this is what's going on here. Christians think they need something they don't, just like smokers think they need something they don't, or gamblers think they need something they don't, or sex addicts or risk addicts, or you name it. Christianity's more of a behavioral addiction than it would be a substance addiction, but the same principle applies in all addictions. You have this thing you think you need, you crave it, you don't think you can live without it, and you come to love it because you think you need it. If you can remove that brainwashing somehow to take it away, to take away the desire, then it's so easy to just stop because you no longer think you need it."
I try to stray away from saying things that I feel like are reasonably controversial, but this is one of them. I believe that's why you see a lot of addicts move in to religion, sometimes heavily into religion, because it is a replacement and a much healthier and better one.
Holy
for the
cow. Bingo. Do I not say that in my book?
You do.
Yeah.
It's exactly how I argue it.
I agree with
you. Yeah, he doesn't poo-poo on that idea at all.
No,
he just says it's brilliant. Better.
That's exactly the point.
You're,
That's why people come to Christianity. And unfortunately, what often happens is they don't just replace the addiction, they add another one because they eventually go back to drinking and smoking anyway.
Yeah, and then you can do both.
And now you're stuck on Jesus and smoking. And so now you've just added another life misery to yourself.
Now you just beat yourself to death because you're doing it. Right. Whereas before, you're actually trying to kill yourself.
Right. No, that makes sense.
Especially ones that have been in the prison.
Yeah.
They will immediately go to a fundamentalist church because of the structure level is the same thing that prison is. Mm-hmm. It has, and I know that's a tough thing to say, but I've actually, you know, come to the realization watching that for myself.
Yeah. And a lot of people that are in prison or either addicts, maybe they do have a loving family, but a lot of times they've been alienated from them because of it.
Oh yeah.
And so when they get into a place that actually wants to be your
community.
Family.
Yeah.
And you know how important community is. So being able to have that is such a huge thing.
It gives them the community with the background of that structure and that authority that the guidelines and the rules. It's all that subconsciousness that they, and I can agree with you on that statement. They think they need it because that's what they were in, and that's what they gave them.
Yeah, I'm with Andy. I mean, and with you too. That it's a replacement. It is.
I think some people do need structure, though. I do.
Yeah.
I think not everybody.
That's true too.
Wants to and feels ready to, or even should be obligated to control themselves on a daily level like that, because the world is stupid and choices are obscure. They don't make a lot of sense. The good way, clear way, the right way forward is frequently completely unclear, and sometimes there's no best choice.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard. That sucks. I get not wanting. I get wanting to outsource that 100%.
Yeah.
Life is, in a lot of ways, just dumb. You want the clarity that comes with that sort of story. You want there to be a right way to do things, and you mm-hmm. want to do it mostly.
And you want to not be alone.
And you want to not be alone. That's massive.
That's huge.
When you're making these difficult life decisions that require a foresight that you can't possibly have because you don't know which degree is going to be the right degree for you. How can you find the right answer? And so having that belief that there's an existential existence that's sort of like, and I've said this to you before, sort of like a sky cam. Like the mm-hmm. helicopter that's looking down and can see all the ways that traffic is going.
Yeah.
And to if you are stuck in traffic, it'd be helpful to it's helpful to believe that you've got a connection to that helicopter that can say, no, take I-5. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That I can see the future. I can see what's going on, and this is going to be the best route for you. You know? Mm-hmm.
Yes. And one of the things that typically humans have this craving for is a reason for things, a meaning, or somebody watching over them. There has to be something beyond this, right?
Yeah. A bigger narrative that makes sense somehow.
Right.
It can be evil even. It's better. A lot of people would much prefer to have evil overlords than chaos.
Sure. When, in fact, it may just—
I mean, look at our country.
It may just be that there's nothing but chaos, and that might be reality. It may be there's no Sky Daddy. It might be that there's no purpose or reason for anything that happens. And the reality is, if that's the case, we can either accept it or we can put ourselves in a matrix and believe something that isn't true, which, as I have discovered, ruins your life. That's my opinion, because I have lived it. And I think there's a lot of people who have lived the life that I've lived, and it's very similar. And and I think it's more damaging than good to find some way to fill that need for purpose and meaning and desire or whatever, when in fact, if there isn't, maybe we can learn to live a different way. Maybe the next best thing of evolution is for us to evolve without religion and without God so that we can discover how to solve these problems without the need for the Sky Daddy.
But it's hard to substitute that ready community. I mean, that's the problem of the modern, to me, it's one of the main problems of the modern era is the lack of third space, the lack of fundamental community. And if there's a problem with atheism, it is just that there's not a good enough reason to put atheists together in a room every week, right?
Well, it's just we're working on that.
You can say there is, but it just doesn't end up working.
Well, it's actually working. It's a slow process because the church is capitalized on that market. I mean, it's been doing this for thousands and thousands of years. So for us to just come in and overnight just be like, hey, snap our fingers and we magically have a community. It's not going to work like that.
Right, sure.
It's going to take us a lot of time, but it also we also have to have theism die a little bit so humanism can rise. Because as long as theism's still strong like this, it's going to be next to impossible for us to come along and be able to capitalize on the same resources that, you know, that
that's true. Churches maybe there's a cultural, my brain is terrible. What's that word when it's not good? A cultural bias. There's enough of a cultural bias against non-religious atheists, whatever you want to call it, people still that's part of what makes organizing difficult. But it's like you need something to organize around. And atheism is not. It's not
as inspiring
a
as the Son of God sacrificing himself for you.
That's absolutely true, yeah. But that's not how I was going to put it. But
it's not a belief, is what
it's
he's
not,
saying.
It's yeah. not a belief. It's like
it's the it's, absence of belief.
Yeah, it's like a, it's like yeah. getting together to talk about how there are no unicorns.
No,
like,
I agree with you. I don't think we're working.
And I am the most atheist person you ever met.
We're not trying to create communities around atheism.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm saying.
We're trying to create
there has to be right.
humanist communities. Right. That's different.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Like, you need to like find right. that other thing.
Atheism's not a thing.
Yeah,
and we're not trying to claim that it is. It's just a disbelief. That's all it is. So no, it's not. You can believe a whole bunch of things and still be a part of a community of humanism.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that was my point exactly. My point is that yeah. they're. You need to just be like, all right, what is yeah. what's the thing?
I agree with you. And so, yeah. like, to your point, yes, it's easier to gather around somebody named Jesus who is a purpose and died for you, whatever. But when you think through that consistently all the way to the end, this is probably going to lend itself to the third show. So I'll throw it out here and then maybe we can talk about it. But, you know, one of the things that we often don't think about when we talk about this wonderful story of Jesus dying is in order for Jesus to die for you, you have to be this horrible, worthless sinner that's no good, evil, and has no value in and of themselves. And you know, imagine telling this to your kids, which most people don't say it like this, but if you're going to be honest with the word and what it teaches, son, you know, you're such a horrible, evil person. You're so bad, God had to kill his own son for you.
That's not, yeah, is that like your, Rick, is that your reading of
the Bible?
How that, yes, of that specific thing.
That was the whole purpose of Christ coming.
Okay. I know that it was because of the sin, but I never read it as because you're a piece of crap.
No,
that,
hold
that,
on.
I never read
here,
it that
it's
way.
It's not the piece of crap. Here it is. The matrix that he's talking about, the matrix of the Bible, is that God made things in a paradise form in perfection with agents that had liberty and gave them options in that to choose right and wrong or to just choose him. By choosing right or wrong, in other words, that knowledge of tree, mm-hmm. you know, that tree of knowledge of good and evil, once that takes place in that paradigm, in that paradise, then they fall. From that moment on, humanity is separated from God. So with that, by being separated from God, you have the knowledge of good and of evil, and mm-hmm. both of those are bad. Remember, both of those are in that, you know, so now we're talking about like morality.
You mean just having the knowledge of God?
Just having that knowledge according to this, again, the matrix of the Bible, if we stay within that. Yeah. The idea is that from that point on, now that mankind has both sides of this, the knowledge of good and evil, rather than choosing to walk with God and just enjoy him in his relationship with in this perfect place, now you've entered into this other realm outside of God, which leads to evil. This knowledge of evil actually becomes continual to the point where it overtakes the whole world. It overtakes everything.
I don't understand what you just said. The knowledge of evil overtakes everything. What do you mean?
Like, in other words, evil wins on this realm.
God. They forgot the knowledge of good and only knew the knowledge of evil.
And even the knowledge of good was suspect. Okay. So again, remember, again, think this of this is, as a matrix. We're splitting the parallel. We're splitting these realms. You've got a realm where this God is good and everything was nice and wonderful and you could eat of the tree of life and live forever. And then when it's split, now you're into a different realm. So once you adopt the Bible, if you look at the Bible, you enter into that matrix, and that's your worldview. That's what you're thinking.
And that
okay?
is the viewpoint of the Bible.
That's
that
right. And the Bible
like descent
does,
into sin is
it
inevitable.
Never stops. It continues to descend. Eventually you get to Noah where the whole world is evil and he's got to drown it. And then you go beyond that.
Yeah, I've met people. They're not that bad, mostly.
Well,
I mean,
we're
flawed, clearly, but...
So, but see now, and the only reason I'm going to interject here is because what we're talking about is the kind of like basic general traditional idea of Christianity as a whole.
Right, right.
In general.
Very helicopter view.
For example, you know, we had Professor Walton on here. The tree of good and evil has absolutely nothing to do with good and evil. It has to do with order or chaos. Those are two different things. Mm-hmm. And that it wasn't a curse, it was a consequence. And so if, and, you know, there's these other, there, the thing is that there are other theologically innovative ways to look at this conversation. However, during the period of time that after Jesus died to where we're sitting right now, what you have had is when there's a crux, when there's a break in the road, when there's a conversation, instead of saying, okay, let's see, let's talk about, you know, a Christology and Arianism. Let's talk about whether or not that Greek word was faith in Christ or the faithfulness of Christ is the example, right? There were lots of options, as a matter of fact. But at some point, somebody came along and said, well, you're not allowed to believe that option anymore. If you're going to be a Christian, you have to believe this option. And if you don't choose this option, well, then we're going to unalive you.
And that's what has happened is what has
kind of coalesced as what we call quote unquote Christianity in reality is just this one particular interpretation and belief system. But you can go read Walter Brueggemann, you can go read John Walton, you can go read, you know, any of these other like theological,
people
I mean, go
that,
read Rachel Held Evans, you can go read any of these other theologically innovative folks that are challenging what I would call a white Western interpretation of the experience that doesn't always include cultural relevance and then allows the story to be extrapolated upon and adjusted in order to fit a society that is completely different than the ones the story was written for. But see, you, what my argument is that you can absolutely be that person. You can absolutely go, I like Jesus, but this version of Christianity is trash. You can shave your head at 23 and give the middle finger to God and then meet Andy Bishop and find out that all the people that they were told were bad and wrong were actually kind of rad and develop fun relationships with people out in the world and have panic attacks at Rosetta's at 10 o'clock at night because you're not supposed to be out here.
But then find out
that you don't go to hell after all.
But you know what? No matter what you say, mm-hmm. with all of that theological innovation, mm-hmm. you cannot escape the fact that God mm-hmm. had to kill his son.
Yes, and—
That is the story.
And,
that's what he just said. That's the story.
But what I'm saying is God had to kill his son, mm-hmm. okay?
For you.
Listen, now this is whether or not you want to get into this right now. We don't have to. God
that's
had to kill
episode.
His son.
We didn't need to talk about how brilliant it was that you were able to break all that stuff down in your brain and then make a book.
I completely derailed this. Let's move back.
If you're talking about preterism, you're talking about eschatology, you're talking about Jesus talking about the kingdom of God and all this whatnot.
Yeah.
Did God have to kill his son? Or did Jesus choose to take on this particular role because Jesus and God knew that there was going to be a destruction of the temple and the sacrificial system as the Jewish people knew it was coming to an end, which absolutely, as Christianity became more and more prominent, the sacrificial systems that existed in Greek and Roman cultures as well at that time also fell away because you have to remember the Roman people were still doing their thing at the time that Christianity was doing its thing, which also included a sacrificial system. The Code of Hammurabi. All ancient Near East religions included a sacrificial system, but if you believe in process theology, because I'm kind of a process
theologian.
You are a
process theologian.
If you read in like the Bible, especially like in Psalms and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, God says it over and over. I don't actually give a shit about this bloodletting business that you guys are all involved in. I don't actually care about your incense. I don't actually care about all of that. I care about being in relationship with you. But because you guys were embedded, Jewish people were embedded in another ancient Near East culture that they were borrowing ideas from, God was like, all right, I'm just going to give you this stupid thing. Sorry, Jews, I'm going to give you this thing because it makes sense to you. But eventually, we're going to do away with this bloodletting thing entirely. I'm going to destroy this temple. I'm going to destroy this entire system of our relationship being an exchange of blood for blood, and we're just going to be done with it once and for all.
But if all he had to do was destroy the temple to do that, then why did Jesus die 40 years earlier?
Exactly. Good question. And I don't have an answer to that.
To take away the sin of the world,
to take away the sin of the world.
Which gets back to his initial
to let go of this entire process of like bloodletting and sacrificial systems and religious ideologies that keep some people here and some people here, to kind of like break that down. And just create a once and for all for everybody that everybody's
welcome.
I feel
like we're
talking
about
two different
things here,
though. That's why Jesus is such a like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you're talking about a whole system of thought that has a complete disconnect from what I said earlier, which is dealing with sin and a savior. Like,
right. But see, I'm thinking what's happening here is that this idea of sin and savior, what I'm saying is that I don't necessarily subscribe to the cultural idea of what sin is or isn't, and then what Jesus did or didn't come to do. I don't necessarily subscribe to that necessarily. That version of the story of Genesis and how sin entered the world. What I'm saying is that there's lots of different ideas about how that happened. But yeah, for some reason, Christianity has coalesced into this one idea, and that if you're going to be a Christian, you have to subscribe to this one thing. And I'm suggesting you don't have to.
My point wasn't, yes, Genesis has, as we know, plenty of interpretations. Like, that's not the issue. Revelation has plenty of interpretations. I'm simply talking about the texts that talk about how there is none righteous, no, not one. All are sinners, fall short of the glory of God. I am like a worm, a magnet that is worthy of nothing. Those kinds of statements, they're in the Bible. They permeate the text.
Right.
You know, so you can't escape the fact that there is a prevalent teaching throughout Scripture that degrades humanity.
Right.
Or at least if you take the world as just Israel, I don't care. Either way, degrades a people group of some sort. And then says, and without Jesus, you're worth nothing.
Like, yeah, see, I don't have enough of the background to appreciate that. I kind of know the idea, obviously, of humans being inevitably sinners is pervasive, but I just don't have... I understand enough text in my brain to like understand.
Right. But it does permeate the text, as Rick was saying, and I'll turn it over to you in a second. But I just wanted to quickly say, I just literally saw this meme on Facebook. And like, we're talking about this, and I just literally, well, look at this meme. I am not ashamed of Jesus Christ. Without him, I am nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the general Christian worldview, although in some churches, they don't teach it as much as like a reformed person would, because we really wanted to drive that home because you need Jesus. But all of this matters, and I'll talk about why in a second, but you go ahead.
The part that he's talking about comes from the fundamental, the mainstream church, that whole premise. He's absolutely right.
It's the text, man. It's really not interpretation. You can't escape those verses.
Well, no, you cannot. But I'm getting further.
Okay.
That is the mainstream thing that, unless you go to church, you just don't hear it. If you go to a typical church here.
I forget how some churches are. The very fire and brimstone, there's a lot of
typical
very
Southern
strong,
church is basically, yes, you cannot be anything without Christ at all.
Yeah, and Rick, you're right. You're not going to hear it in a lot of churches, because a lot of churches have discovered, if we walk around telling people how horrible they are, they're probably not going to come to my church. Kind of like if you tell people how to kill God the easy way, they're probably not going to read your book. Right? Mm-hmm. It's the same idea. So they've strayed away from that, because let's be softer and let's just try to win people through marketing. When in fact, the opposite is true. If people don't realize how worthless they are without Jesus, why would you need Jesus?
Right.
I mean, that's the whole premise. Like, I need Jesus because... I'm nothing without him.
But what if the world needed Jesus at a particular time in history? They needed him, and they had to have him.
Well, theoretically, we all needed him to die in that moment.
That'd be a technicality. Okay. But because our audience relevance is never applied appropriately or consistently, we don't understand the original premise of what you're talking about what we needed Christ for.
Yeah, like you don't need to heed the, you should have never heard those words today. That's what Rick's saying. You should have never heard that about yourself today.
No.
Well, that's great coming from a universalist, but you're rare. You're a rare breed.
You should have never heard it.
But it's in the text, though. That's the problem, is what do you do with that?
Well, the thing is,
I could easily tell you what you do with it. And I could tell anybody what to do with it.
I'm going to tell you where to stick it.
Because you don't need it. Audience relevance from the standpoint of where that's the true hermeneutical primary fact or the main pinnacle of hermeneutics is audience relevance. And almost any writing today, that should be what the primary thing is audience relevance. I'll always stand by that one thing. You, I, anybody today should have never heard those words. But we should hear.
Only from a historical perspective. That's it. He's saying you don't look at it from a present perspective. Your present is not that.
Exactly.
That was a historical thing. And so,
right, because Jesus took care of it all.
But you should be able, you should be taught it in the right context, in the right way, so that you know that what he did do was important so that we would have what we have today.
So understanding the universalist perspective, you would argue that faith isn't necessary to have the work of Christ applied, but you still have to have a reason why the work of Christ needs to be applied at all in the first place.
Well, I mean, in general, to have any belief in the system, I have to have faith. Because I've got to believe it.
Yeah, but somebody that's not a faith can still go to heaven in your worldview, right?
I don't believe in heaven. See, that's the thing. That's the other thing. I don't know that, but see, that's the other thing. Because in preterist view, if you look at all of the time statement, the heaven statements, especially like in Matthew, the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven is like this. He's not talking about an actual place that exists, like a physical being. Jesus is talking about an idea.
Sure, I wasn't. Heaven, no heaven. Right, right. Yeah. That's not my point.
But it's a label.
Thanks a lot, Andy.
Yes, good
job,
Andy.
Well, it's okay. And here's the thing. I literally have no dog in this fight anymore.
Yeah.
My point is...
Well, but...
My point is simply...
What if you did?
My point is simply this.
And you do.
No matter what your worldview is, if you are a Christian and you have some sort of need for Christ, you also have a reason you need Christ.
Right.
That is an essential...
Right, there has to be a value.
There has to be a value. Yeah, you can't just say, well, Jesus just did what he did, and I think it's a really nice story. Thank you, Jesus.
Do you historically believe in him at all, period?
I think he may have been a real human. I don't think the legend of Jesus is real.
Yeah, same-sies.
But I don't care. It doesn't affect my life one way or the other if he did or didn't. Mm-hmm. Either way, we have stories in the Bible, and they're good enough.
That's not true. That's not true at all.
What do you mean it's not
you
true?
You can't say that.
Why?
Because
I missed
he
it. It
did
went
affect
so fast.
Your life. He affected your life for 40 plus years.
Yeah, that's...
No.
But you say it in a negative light.
The story
but he
affected
still affected
life.
You.
Well, I don't know. I think that the high control religion affected him.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know that he had an opportunity
about this particular desert
really
creature
have.
That may or may not have existed has affected everybody's life in this room.
The theory that he may have existed did, of course. But
that's the point. My point is that Jesus affected everybody in this room.
Sure,
whether
Santa
like
Claus
it or
affected
not.
Everybody in this room, too.
Not me.
Well, you didn't believe in Santa Claus as a kid?
I wasn't allowed.
Okay, well, I
was. No, I was lying. But I was just trying to play the
devil's
advocate.
Of course you were, but that's the point. Just because it's not real doesn't mean the idea doesn't affect you.
Yeah, okay. I was talking about, you can look at it in a negative light if you'd like. I'm just saying that he affected you whether you liked it or not.
The only thing is we cannot historically dig him up, Santa Claus, and prove any existence whatsoever.
But we're still off track here.
Yes, we can.
Actually,
Santa Claus.
We're still off track here, guys. I'm still focused on this one.
Nicholas and Myra.
We're just like still on topic.
Guys, where did everybody decide? When was it decided that Santa Claus is dead? When did that happen?
Rick? Well, St. Nick. One or two St. Nick.
All right, listen. Will you have went off the rails? Hold on. I'm
going to
bring this back. I want to bring this back. Okay.
Where were we in life?
We have to end this episode because we've wasted all this time. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to go into the next episode. If you guys can hang out, great. If you can't, I need to get to the baseline of his book about how he constructed it because he constructs it in his own life and then he sets out to write the same thing that Alan Carr did. We still haven't learned about him
uncovering the invisible scaffolding that
and
he
just
laid.
Because we're getting to the end does not mean that I'm done with you, Alan. We can have Zoom call after Zoom call. We can keep doing this. But
I'm in on that.
We will. We'll continue it on. But let's finish this episode on a high note. Is anyone got any weed?
Yeah.
Okay. So you guys ever seen Forgetting Sarah Marshall?
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever seen that movie?
It's been a long time.
I love that part where the guy goes to the beach and he's going to learn how to surf. Yeah. And he walks up and Paul Rudd's character, his name's Kunu.
Uh-huh.
And he's sitting there and he's like, hey, man, you look like you got some sadness behind those eyes. You know what'll fix it? He's like, what? He goes, weed. You got any? It's like, no, sorry, man.
So we can go through the ashtray on the front porch. You never know. Hey, kids, it's a recording studio.
It is. Yeah, you always want to come in post-rapper's recording. That's when you want to be here.
Get a little contact while you're at it.
Yeah, Alan, I appreciate you being here, man.
So you guys just
hang out. We'll get into episode 3 on our Super Bondar Friday.
Super Bondar.
Super Bondar Fridays.
I want that t-shirt.
It's going to change from an A to Super B.
I want like a noise to Super Bondar, like an anime style, like card that they put between scenes or after a commercial.
Something like that.
They'll ask you, what's that B stand for? It's not hope, kids.
I don't know if Tiziana is going to have to mom so hard that she can't be in the third room. She's got to go put her kids
to
bed.
He says, no, we're fine. Go do your thing.
Oh, you still get to mom. You don't have to mom so hard yet.
I don't have to mom so hard
yet. Andy, I appreciate you, man.
Yep.
As always.
Rick, appreciate you, bro. All right. We'll talk to you guys again next time on the Burrs of Berea. Peace out.
Later.
That was chaos, but it was good chaos. Thank you.
What if your self-help coach was your captor? What if empowerment meant obedience? And a colored sash meant you belonged to someone? This is the true story of Nexium, a personal development company that promised growth and delivered control. We're going inside the minds behind the headlines. Keith Raniere, the so-called genius who weaponized belief. Nancy Saltzman, the therapist who professionalized submission. And Allison Mack, the actress who helped brand women into silence. We'll hear from survivors, whistleblowers, and the families who fought to bring the truth to light. This isn't just a cult story. It's a case study in how ambition, psychology, and charisma can become chains. Listen to our new series of Sashes and Slaves, coming soon, only on Patreon. Go to www.patreon.com/theburrowsofberea.
Keep up, Carter. God. I kind of want you to come on the show and talk to me about how you came up to, with how you got to universalism.
Sure. It's a long story, and it's a good one.
Is it?
We're gone.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I mean, it goes through full preterism and then his interpretation of the Bible. We are very close. We are actually very, very close. It's just I have this one, like two little hangups that bother me.
Let's do that one of these times. Let's do that next for notes, just for fun.
He doesn't technically have a hangup. He just wants to hold on to
it. Is it Rick's hangups? Rick's hangups with full preterism? Yeah. Is that the...
But we're just talking about my hangups with universalism.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's only a couple. It would make my life a lot simpler, honestly.
Yeah.
It really would.
If you could just believe it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what Alan says about me becoming an atheist, too. He's like, it'd really make your life a lot simpler.
What would really make everyone's life a lot simpler if they would just give themselves permission to believe whatever they want and not ask anyone else to co-sign it?
That would be neat.
You know? Yeah. And if we could just allow one another to believe whatever we wanted and not ask that we co-sign it, you know? Like, that would make everybody's life a lot easier.
Carter and I earlier were talking about how people hate universalists because they're just too nice. Like, you can't be that nice. You got to go to hell.
Oh, boy. And that's how it works out. Are we ready? We rolling in?
Oh, see, yes, he's gone there, but I don't know. I'm not gotten that far to being the hated one.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's kind of that same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't hate you. I love you.
No.
Oh, we all love you too,
brother.
I love all of you. You know how it works. It's just an unfortunate thing for you guys. I'm sorry. All right, we are rolling, Andy?
Yep.
All right.